history for middle and high school students and everyone in between who wants to learn a little bit while we're out of school due to this coronavirus crisis. In this series, we're going to be discussing all the topics that you would cover in world history too. We will start today by discussing the topic of the Renaissance. In our previous podcast, we discussed the bubonic plague and the spread during the mid-1300s. And now we're looking at how the Renaissance sort of came out of this dark period of world history. So, I am joined again by my guests, Kevin Beato.
Hello.
And Mr. Nicholas Rushkevitz.
Hello.
Today, gentlemen, we're going to be discussing how the Renaissance was able to come out of something horrible like the plague. One of the first things that people will tell you, every little seventh grader will tell you, Mr. Horho, the Renaissance means rebirth. Okay. So, Nick, Kevin, can you go ahead and tell us basically how did the Renaissance come out of a horrible thing like the plague?
All right, so we have the plague, and we talked about that in our last podcast episode, as you mentioned. But to kind of go back on it just really quick and recap things, we know that the plague was this deadly disease. We know that it wipes out a lot of the population of Europe in particular. We see the loss of up to a third of the total population there. Urban centers were devastated. The disease spread very quickly. But as a result of this, because so many people were killed as a result of the plague, we see a rise in wages. So there were fewer workers available, and the ones who were available were in high demand. People who needed work done needed to give them higher wages or better conditions, and that leads to the rise of a middle class. It also starts to lead to the end to feudalism, because as these people earned more money, these former peasants or serfs were now able to afford to purchase their freedom. Before this, they were kind of bound to the land. They were forced to stay on the land that they kind of belonged to. Now they had the money to purchase their freedom and kind of start their own lives. So it leads to a kind of a change to the economy, particularly in Italy, where this all really gets started. It leads to a more sophisticated economy. It leads to more trading. It leads to more merchants, because we now have, you know, a middle class that has a little bit more money to spend on things. And it leads to sort of a change from like this feudalist system that we saw in the Middle Ages. So, yeah, that's kind of like the big change we see happening in Italy and eventually through Europe at that time.
During the 1300s, the 1200s, if you were an artist, for the most part, you were making things for the church. But when the Renaissance starts to happen, and it's worth pointing out that the Renaissance was not, you know, a specific date in history. It's a time period that takes place over hundreds of years. And so as the Renaissance is taking place, we start to see big, big changes, particularly in the field of art. These wealthy families, as Nick mentioned, they start to become very, very rich, and they can spend money on entertainment. And so they start to hire people to write plays. They start to hire people to make sculptures and paintings and all kinds of fun things. So, Nick, what kind of impact did the Renaissance have on Italian culture?
It had a number of impacts here. If you remember back to our last podcast episode, you'll remember that we did talk about a decline in the faith of the church. We mentioned that gave rise to this idea of secularism, kind of like a focus on life on earth that was not entirely focused around religion. And although we see a decline in the church, religion is still going to be important. A lot of the art we'll see during the Renaissance, during this time where kind of there's a rise in secularism or kind of a separation from strictly being a religious life, a lot of the art is still very religious at that time. So it still does hold an important place, but definitely a decline in the power of the church. Some of the problems we saw was the inability of the church to stop the spread of the plague, and then also with many of the church clergy members dying during the plague, they were forced to quickly replace those members with people who were not well-trained and maybe didn't have the best intentions. So it led to a decline in the faith of the church, but religion's still going to hold an important role. And we will see that in Renaissance art. We also saw a difference in Italy, a divide that can still actually be seen there today between northern Italy and southern Italy. In the north, where there was rich farmland, a lot of the former landowners, the ruling class, gave more freedom or allowed their serfs who had lived on the land, as I mentioned, to purchase their freedom. And it led to a more prosperous and complex society. Whereas in southern Italy, rulers actually strengthened restrictions on serfs, and it led to southern Italy not seeing the same prosperity as northern Italy. And that is still actually the case today. So when we look back at history and when we say, well, you know, this happened 500 years ago, surely the effects of something that happened all that time ago can't be seen today in society. We can see it pretty clearly in Italy. Going back to this time period, we can see a divide forming between southern Italy and northern Italy that's still there today, and it actually came up.
Kevin, I have a question. How did art change during the Renaissance? And I ask about that because usually if kids walk in the door in the first day of school, in high school or in middle school, and you talk about the Renaissance, they pretty much can name a couple of artists, and that's about it. But how did art change?
So art changed in a number of different ways. So you have artists who are now making a lot more money because in northern Italy, they're a lot more prosperous and they're able to, they have time for art and they can fund it. So you get people like Michelangelo doing these grand works on the ceiling of the Sistine Chapel. But the style of it changed. If you look at Middle Ages art, it's pretty flat, two-dimensional. It's not very lifelike. But with the rise of humanism in the Renaissance, the art took on that as well. So they try to do realistic depictions of people and activities. So you have things like Raphael, who a lot of you might know as a Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtle. His most well-known work is the School of Athens, which is in the Vatican. And it shows in Athens, it looks three-dimensional too, and the people look very lifelike in it. So you see people in the foreground, and it looks like it has depth going all the way back down the hallway that you can see there. And it shows them sort of sitting around, talking, studying, reading, as opposed to something in the Middle Ages where you're not seeing that life, that human element sort of in the artwork.
You hit on exactly what I was going to say. Kids will walk in, and one of my favorite ways to start class is to ask, can you name four Renaissance artists? And usually they can't. And I'll go, Leonardo, Donatello, Michelangelo, and Raphael. And the kids will say, why are you talking about Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles? But of course, they were named after famous Renaissance artists. So this is for both of you. I was wondering if you guys could tell me a little bit about why Italy was such a hotspot for these Renaissance artists. And a little bit about each of the aforementioned artists.
Italy's location was a big part of it. We talked about how there was a growth of a middle class, increased demand for trade following the plague. And Italy being located in the right on the Mediterranean Sea was a center of trade. You could have ships going across the Mediterranean to different areas to trade for goods and to bring them back. And from there, they could even be shared throughout Europe and traded throughout Europe. Also, I think in Italy, the plague had led to kind of a questioning mentality there. You know, people started to begin to question the status quo, to start considering things about religion and about politics and stuff like that. And this led them to sort of look back to the past, you know, the classical time period with ancient Rome and ancient Greece and what they were doing. And that is kind of where we get this term Renaissance or rebirth. They kind of looked back at these ancient cultures and the questioning attitudes that they had. And one of the areas that they also really questioned was like the human form and the human body and stuff like that. So I think that kind of helps us to understand where kind of the mentality was coming from in Italy, or why the Renaissance may have gotten a start there.
So yes, Donatello, Leonardo, Michelangelo, and Raphael. We already touched on Raphael a little bit. But the other three, it's actually cool. Kind of interesting. They're all from Florence.
Kevin,
Florence being sort of
the
hot spot here in the Renaissance at this stage. And a lot of that came from it being a very wealthy area. The reason it was so wealthy was because of textiles mainly. So they would have the best textiles essentially in Europe, and they would use that to trade, and they'd make a lot of money. Now, they did a lot of trade with the Ottomans, who were in Turkey at the time, because they had this thing called alum, which would help them with dyeing their wool, and it would help make it more vibrant. It would last longer. But then the Medicis actually found a natural source of alum in around Florence. So now they can just go right to there. And now you have people like the Medicis who are making money hand over fist. And now they can fund these artists like Donatello, Leonardo da Vinci, and Michelangelo. Donatello and Michelangelo were both sculptors, and they both created sculptures of the biblical figure David. Now, Donatello did a bronze one, and it's a bit more warrior-like, and then Michelangelo had the plain marble version of it as well, which is very well known. And then you also have Leonardo da Vinci, who does things like the Mona Lisa, which is noted for being super lifelike. And actually, when you go and see it, it actually looks kind of eerie because it looks like it's tracking you as you walk across the room with the eyes.
Yeah, one thing that I love about Leonardo da Vinci is that he was sort of known as like the Renaissance man. He was an artist, right? As you said, he did the Mona Lisa, but he was also a beautiful sculptor, as you also mentioned, but he was also an inventor. And so if you look, there was da Vinci's flying machine, where he basically came up with the design for a glider. Da Vinci was like fixated on studying the human body and the human form. And one of the amazing things is that in a lot of medical journals, Da Vinci's drawings were used to teach medical students, because he was able to imagine where the muscles were and where the tendons were with such precision that it turns out when they started to do autopsies of people, when they started to look at people, that Da Vinci was correct for the most part. With the placement of muscles and tendons and those things. So if you ever look at a book like Grey's Anatomy, there are a bunch of drawings that are very similar to the drawings that Da Vinci did hundreds of years ago.
Yeah, Da Vinci and Michelangelo studied dead bodies, which is how they got a lot of their realistic figures in their artwork.
Yep. One of my favorite little pieces of information here. When you watch Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles, as I did, you know, growing up in the early 90s, you would see all the Ninja Turtles, and then they were being taught by a radical rat, Master Splinter. And it was not until I started teaching the Renaissance that I realized Splinter was an actual person. So his name was Tommaso di Ser Giovanni di Simone. He was also known as Moccasio. I did not say that right. He was a Florentine artist who was regarded as the first great Italian painter of the Renaissance era. And so it's just sort of cool that even as a child, you're exposed to these things and you don't understand what they mean. But these connections are all there going back to different Renaissance artists. I was hoping that you could tell us a little bit about Niccolò Machiavelli. He was a famous writer and politician in Italy during the time of the Renaissance.
Yeah, so you see this rise in artwork and music in the Renaissance, but you also see a new rise in philosophy. So in Italy, you have Machiavelli, Niccolò Machiavelli, and you know elsewhere you get people like Erasmus and Thomas More. So it's not just Machiavelli, but you have others who are creating these philosophical works. Machiavelli from Florence, go figure. His big work was The Prince, which is essentially, it's an individualistic look at how someone would go about being sort of their ideal leader. And the whole nutshell of it is that the ends justify the means. In other words, as he would put it, it was better to be feared as a leader than loved.
So during my Renaissance unit, when I'm teaching my class. One of the things that we do is with the Renaissance, we talk about those artists, we talk about the writers, the philosophy, sort of like the social sciences, but there's also like the hard sciences that are starting to develop during this time period. So when looking at the Renaissance, we think about art, but it turns out science and the scientific revolution was just getting going, particularly in terms of space and discovery. So Nick, what can you tell me about the studies of the heavens above?
Ah, yeah, interesting stuff. So, yeah, with all of this, we talked about how people started to develop a bit of a questioning attitude during this time. They started to question the status quo that had been around for years and years. And part of that questioning carried over into the world around them, looking at kind of physical things that could be observed and asking questions about why. It was no longer just kind of like that's the way it is, or we started to see like kind of this scientific questioning, this scientific revolution, as it's sometimes called. So some of the people involved in that, we've got Galileo Galilei. He used the telescope to examine the stars above to just get take a look at Jupiter's moons. Some of the stuff that he kind of stated or discovered was opposed by the church, and he ended up actually on house arrest because the church disagreed with his work. He was also told to recant or take back what he had said because the ideas that he was proposing kind of opposed what the church was teaching at the time. We also have Copernicus. And he develops the theory of heliocentrism, basically that the sun is the center of the universe, not the earth. Prior to this, the Catholic Church had taught that the earth was the center of the universe. So again, this is another example of somebody questioning or challenging the power of the church, which would have been really kind of unthinkable during the Middle Ages. Now that is starting to happen. We see that starting to develop. So Copernicus, through his observations, states that the sun is the center of the universe and that the earth goes around the sun. The sun does not go around the earth, which is what the church had been teaching at that time. Again, the church is opposed to this. They did not want people questioning what they had said and kind of what had been the status quo for a long period of time there. And then we have Johannes Kepler. So Kepler is known for kind of expanding on Copernicus's heliocentric theory. He developed the laws of planetary motion, basically that they were planets kind of had this orbit around the sun that was an ellipse shape.
Education changes permanently in 1450 when books and other writings are now mass-produced. Can you tell me, Kevin, about how books and other works were created before 1450, and how it changed after 1450?
So prior to this new invention, which will come about in the 1450s, anytime you had to make a new copy of a book, you were literally copying it by hand. So books weren't really all that common back then. And, you know, also it was limited generally in what language they were produced in. A lot of times it was in Latin. So if you wanted to learn something, you had to A, find a book, B, know how to understand Latin, and also know how to read it, which was a big issue. Then in 1450, you see Johannes Gutenberg's printing press come about, which was a movable type printing press, which allowed books to be mass produced for the first time, really. And in the first 50 years after the printing press was invented, you saw 20 million volumes of works from like books, legal documents, etc., being printed, which is huge. And it helped spread ideas from Italy to the rest of Europe. It also helped make knowledge more accessible in that books were being now produced in, you know, the languages of the people. So it was much easier for people to have access to this. So they didn't have to know Latin necessarily to understand what was coming out of, you know, the minds of Machiavelli or Thomas More. You could just go and read it in your native language if you knew how to read, though.
Yeah, that would still be an issue because at the time that we're talking about, there wasn't stuff like just being able to go to school. There wasn't like a public school system where children would go to learn to read and stuff like that. Education was still kind of reserved for usually royal individuals or people who had a lot of wealth. It wasn't something that was so easily accessible. But this does make a change because with the creation of the printing press, as Kevin mentioned, it reduces the time it takes to produce a book. It no longer has to be handwritten. And because less time is needed to produce copies of a book, that means the cost of those books can go down because it's not taking as much of your time to create it. You can create now, say, 20 or 50 books in the time it would take you to make one. So it reduces the cost of books. It makes books more common in Europe, and that makes them more accessible to people who are not extremely wealthy. So we do start to see a bit of a change here. This is kind of the era where we see reading becoming more prominent in society, people being able to read, more people being able to read and kind of understand these ideas that are going to be going around.
So the printing press changes the game. And so now ideas can be spread around Europe and around much of the world pretty quickly. In our next episode, we're going to be discussing one of the most famous works that was copied on the Gutenberg press, Martin Luther's 95 Theses, as we start to discuss the Reformation and the split inside the church. For Nick, for Kevin, and for myself, thank you for joining us today. Have a great day and stay safe.